sizes, and then the killing would commence again. The parking lot was dark when the cab returned Parker to the inn. Someone had broken the main outside light in the interim, casting in shadow the section of the lot in which Parker's Audi stood. He opened the door and noted that the interior bulbs did not activate. He said nothing as he got in the car, nothing as he drove away. Nothing to the figure, lying uncomfortably on the floor in the back, concealed by a dark blanket. Gun in hand. Quayle called Parker's phone while he and Louie were heading toward Piscataquis County, just as Quayle had instructed him to do before leaving Salvage.
"You have the book?"
Quayle asked Parker.
"Yes."
"Then take down this zip code."
Parker repeated the zip as he inputted into the car's GPS, which immediately began calculating the route, guiding Parker toward Waterville.
"Is someone in the car with you?"
said Quayle.
"No, but I'm old and I miss here."
"Don't be clever, Mr. Parker. Not if you want Owen Weaver returned alive."
"If Owen Weaver dies, you'll never see the book again."
Quayle hung up, and Parker headed northwest. Waterville was a little more than an hour from Portland. If Parker guessed right, this would be only the first in a possible series of stops. He was pretty certain that he wasn't currently being tailed, but he'd probably pick up a spotter when he reached Waterville, either Quayle or the woman, depending on who was watching Owen Weaver. That was how Parker would have done it, just as he would have tagged the vehicle in which he was traveling, given time, or installed a listening device, anything to gain an edge. For now, Parker had no way of knowing if his car had been tampered with, which was why he was staying silent. He did not want to give away Louis's presence. Quayle might have his suspicions, but if Parker handled everything right, suspicions they would remain. He found First Wave on Sirius, turned the volume down low, and let the sounds of early 80s British synth music fill the car. He ignored the small moan of torment from behind. Parker was skirting Waterville when the phone rang again.
"Get off the interstate and take the 104 into town," said Quayle,
and Parker did as instructed. Quayle stayed on the line and told Parker to pull over across from the McDonald's on Main. Vehicles were parked on both sides of the road and in the surrounding lots, including three or four outside the McDonald's itself. Parker waited until Quayle gave him an address on Ash Street, farther down off Main. This time, Parker did not repeat the address aloud. Louis, who had been following their progress on his own phone, would have to trust him. Parker watched the road behind and spotted no signs of pursuit. But at least one of the cars in the McDonald's lot had been occupied, the shape of a driver clear at the wheel. He was prepared to lay good money on someone checking to make sure he was alone. This was confirmed when he received two more calls in quick succession, sending him back on his previous route before proceeding through a series of residential streets until finally he was left to wait at a dead end on Butler Court. Parker tensed. He heard Louis shift position, and the rear door clicked as it was opened slightly in case of trouble. The agreed signal was a cough from Parker. But this place didn't feel right for a handover, or an attempt to seize the book. When the phone rang again, Parker was not entirely surprised. The delay, he felt, was probably to allow whoever had been monitoring Parker to go on ahead.
"New destination," said Quayle,
and something in his voice told Parker that this was it. They were coming to the end. The GPS was giving an hour and 15 minutes to Piscataquis County as he pulled away from the curb. As though speaking to himself, he said, "Here we go." Daniel Weaver was asleep, lulled by the motion of the vehicle. His head lay on his mother's lap. The driver had given her a blanket to cover him, although the car was warm. Other than to tell them that his name was Carl, inquire about the temperature, and point out the bottles of water in the side compartments of the doors, the driver spoke little to them. He was not uncaring, quite the opposite. Holly regularly caught him glancing at them in the rearview, his eyes soft, but he was careful not to intrude. The car was a Mazda hatchback, clean but nothing fancy. like jazz played on the radio. Only when they had passed Augusta did Holly ask Carl where he was taking them.
Bangor, had come the reply. You'll be safe there.
They were approaching the outskirts of the city when Carl left the highway. He made a couple of turns before pulling up in front of a pair of houses guarded by security gates, which opened at their approach. A woman stood silhouetted in the doorway of one of the buildings. She waited for Carl to help the Weavers from the car, Daniel woozy at being woken from his sleep. It took Holly a moment to notice that the woman had Down syndrome.
"I'm Candy," she said. "Welcome to the Tender House."
Chapter 114. Parker was sure he'd made the correct call when the GPS took him along a road marked private, the evergreens along its edges encroaching like shards of a greater blackness against the night sky. When the phone rang again, he pulled over to the side of the road and did not look over his shoulder as the rear door on the right opened and Louis slipped out.
"Why have you stopped?" said Quayle, giving Parker the final confirmation he required. Wherever Quayle was, he could see the Audi.
"The road is dark. I don't want to end up in a ditch."
Parker wondered if Quayle was using an infrared lens to observe the car. If so, Parker could only hope the trees would work in their favor and that Louis was staying low. He held his breath and released it only when Quayle began to speak again.
"There's a turnoff to your right, about a quarter of a mile ahead. Take it and continue driving until you see two houses. You'll spot an oil can in the yard. Don't proceed beyond it. Stop and wait. But be sure to keep your hands on the wheel. And leave the phone on speaker."
Parker did as he was told. He drove slowly along the road until he came to the turn, which took him uphill. The road was even rougher and narrower than before. If another car appeared from the opposite direction, one of them would have to learn to levitate. But he encountered no other vehicles, and eventually two dwellings came into view. The first looked like a pretty standard main camp, a single-story wood cabin that probably contained just a couple of bedrooms, a living area, and a bathroom. The other building was larger and older, consisting of two levels topped by a curiously ornate cupola. Although the whole structure had long fallen into disrepair, and anyone taking up residence would have been forced to share with some of the local wildlife. Parker pulled up at the oil can, but kept the engine running. He didn't think Quayle planned to kill him, or not before the book was safely in his possession. So when Moores emerged from the bushes to his left, a gun in her hand, he tried not to fear actively for his life. Of Quayle, he saw no sign.
"Turn off the ignition," said Quayle's voice from the phone.
Parker did so, and silence reigned for a time. Moores ceased her advance, but kept him under the gun.
"Are you armed?"
"Yes," said Parker.
"Get out of the car and kneel on the ground," Quayle instructed. "Tell Miss Moores what you're carrying, and she will relieve you of its burden."
Parker opened the door, keeping his hands raised once he was out in the open, before easing himself onto the damp gravel. Within seconds, Moores was behind him.
"Where is it?"
she said. "Holster under my left shoulder." She moved around until she was facing him.
"Reach in and remove it with your left hand, thumb and index finger only."
Awkwardly, Parker took out the gun and held it before him like a dead fish.
"Gently throw it at my feet."
Parker did as he was told. The gun landed an inch from her right foot.
"Any others?"
"No."
"I'm going to frisk you. If I find more weapons, I'll shoot you."
Parker decided against dying. "Knife in my left shin, revolver in an ankle holster on my right."
"Lie flat, hands on the back of your head, fingers interlocked."
The ground smelled of spilled gas, and up close, Parker could see the glitter of broken glass. He tried to avoid putting his face against it while Moores removed the knife and the revolver before frisking him anyway, just for her own peace of mind.
"You should see a doctor," Parker said when her face was close to his, and he could smell the foulness of her breath. "I think you may have cancer."
Moores didn't reply, but seconds later she used a foot to spread Parker's legs before kicking him hard in the balls. His vision went black, and he curled in upon himself, eyes closed.
"You mustn't be rude," said Moores.
Parker stayed still for a while, until he was sure he wasn't going to puke. He was just getting to his knees again when Quail materialized from the old house and stepped down to the yard.
"It's not wise to goad her," he said. "She's led a difficult life."
Parker's pain was slowly receding, but nausea was taking its place. He now wanted to hurt Moores very badly. Quail squatted before him.
"The book," he said.
"Owen Weaver," Parker replied.
"That's not how it's going to work. If I don't have the book in my hands within the next 30 seconds, I'll take my chances and tell Miss Moores to kill you."
Parker saw no sense in arguing.
"The book is in the trunk."
"Get it."
Parker managed to rise to his feet. He was unsteady, and it hurt to walk, but at least he was staying upright. Moores and Quail tracked him to the rear of the car, but from different angles. They were understandably wary of the trunk, just in case Parker had not come alone after all. But they were looking in the wrong place, which was all that mattered. Parker opened the trunk. The book lay in its shoebox, the front cover facing up.
"Hand it to me," said Quail.
Parker picked up the book, holding it so that Quail could see the blank pages loosely inserted.
"Owen Weaver," Parker said again.
"Mr. Weaver," Quail shouted, "let us know you're alive."
"I'm okay,"
said a voice from inside the house. Parker guessed Weaver was on the second story, because one of the windows to the front was open. Parker extended the book toward Quail, who reached for it. When his fingers were within touching distance, Parker relaxed his grip, and the book fell apart, the wind sending the pages skipping across the dirt. A number of things then happened simultaneously. Quail followed the progress of the pages, already moving to try to catch them. Moores shifted the barrel of her gun and pulled the trigger, firing not at Parker, but at the figure of Louie emerging from the trees. Parker, caught between two guns, dove to the ground, jarring his tender balls painfully in the process, and scrambled to where his own weapons lay. And finally, the first floor of the old house burst into flames. Chapter 115. Holly Weaver made her son a mug of hot chocolate in the kitchen of the tender house and brewed a cup of tea for herself. It was past Daniel's bedtime, but he showed no signs of wanting to sleep. It was almost, she thought, as though he knew a conversation between them was both necessary and imminent. The tender house was quiet. Four of the other bedrooms were occupied, two of them by women and children, and two by women alone. Holly had already exchanged words in passing with a couple of the women and learned their names. But the kids, both girls of a similar age to her son, were in bed by the time she and Daniel arrived. Daniel might meet them over breakfast in the morning, according to Molly Bow, who introduced herself once Candy had shown Holly and Daniel inside. Holly had never heard of the Tender House, although she'd encountered her share of victims of domestic violence. It was hard to be a woman in this world and not pick up on rumors or even glimpse the evidence, but she never imagined she'd end up in a shelter herself. It made her feel ashamed. She wanted to knock on doors and explain that she wasn't here because a husband or boyfriend had beaten her, threatened rape, or abused her child. She was hiding behind these walls because it was possible that a violent man might want to hurt her and her boy. But then she realized that had she made such an admission, the other women might well have nodded their heads in understanding and pointed out that they were all in this place because of the fear of injury or death at the hands of men, and it didn't much matter what mask their assailants might wear or what their relationship to them might be. No one here was any better or worse than another, and there was no shame in seeking help when faced with male rage.
Now Holly sat Daniel on the double bed that they were to share, in a room filled with just enough color and quirk, and Holly held her son to her as he sipped his hot chocolate and said,
I have something to tell you.
Chapter 116. Events move fast in a gunfight, particularly when the participants are in close proximity, as Heb Caldicott had learned to his cost. The gunfight at the OK Corral lasted just 30 seconds, and left 6 of the 9 participants dead or wounded at the end. So by the time Parker had retrieved his gun and was ready to fire, Louis was already slumped against a tree, bleeding heavily from one wound to his right shoulder and a second to his groin. Quail and Moores were disappearing into the woods, and the yard was bathed in the glow of fire. Somewhere inside the old house, Owen Weaver was screaming. It had taken about 15 seconds for everything to go to hell. Parker first tended to Louis. The injury to his shoulder looked like a bad graze, but the wound to the groin was serious. Parker took off his jacket, wadded it tightly, and forced Louis to maintain pressure on the injury. Louis moaned, but managed to hold the compress in place.
I hit her, said Louis, but she didn't go down.
Parker wanted to head after Quail and Moores. He wished for nothing less than to watch them bleed. But he would not leave Louis, and Owen Weaver was trapped by the conflagration. Parker thought he heard a car starting over the crackle and roar of flames, but he ignored it. Instead, he called 911 and gave the dispatcher directions to the property, even as he was pulling a blanket from the trunk of the Audi and dousing it with the container of water he stored there in case of emergencies. He soaked a rag, tied it around his face as best he could, and headed for the house. The heat and smoke were already intense, and the fire was feeding on the staircase. It couldn't have progressed so far or moved so fast without an accelerant, and Parker knew then that Quail had never intended for him or Owen Weaver to survive the night. Parker placed the blanket over his head and upper body and tried to stay low, moving as quickly as he could up the stairs as the fire bit at his shoes. The ends of his jeans ignited, and he could feel the skin on his legs start to blister, but he held off until he got to the landing, which was still clear, before reaching down to pat out the flames. Owen Weaver was lying on his side in a room to the left, still tied to a chair. His feet were bare, the left foot badly swollen, its toes misshapen. The work of Moores, Parker guessed. He figured that Owen Weaver must have fallen while trying to free himself, and it might just have been for the best. The fire had not yet risen to this level, but the smoke had, and the floor offered the possibility of breathable air. Parker knelt beside the semi-conscious man and examined the plastic restraints used to bind him to the arms and legs of the old carver. Parker's knife lay on the dirt outside, and he couldn't risk using a boot to break the arms and legs of the chair because he might well fracture Weaver's arms and legs in the process. Parker searched the room and found some old cardboard. He rolled it into a cylinder and held it to the flames that were now spreading to the landing. The staircase and its walls were now entirely ablaze. He and Weaver wouldn't be going out the way they'd come in, if they were lucky enough to escape at all. The cardboard caught, and Parker returned to Weaver, closing the door behind him. He placed the flame against the ties and watched them melt, burning Weaver's skin in the process, but also shocking him back to full consciousness. When he was free, Parker raised him up and helped him to the window. "I'm gonna lower you down," Parker told him, as Weaver kept his injured foot off the floor. "It'll hurt when you land, but being burned alive will hurt a lot more." Weaver nodded, but his eyes were glazed. Parker realized that Weaver would be largely a passive participant in what was to come. The window was painted shut, and Parker had to kick out its panes. He gazed into the night, hoping to see fire engines coming up the road, just as they would in a movie. But he could discover no trace of their approach, although he heard or imagined sirens in the distance. Louis was still sprawled against the tree and lifted a hand to let Parker know he was holding on. Flames were sprouting from between the floorboards, and the smoke was now so thick that Parker could no longer see the chair to which Owen Weaver had been tied. He made sure the sharp edges of glass on the window were all removed,
before he maneuvered Weaver into position so that his lower body hung down and his upper half remained over the frame. Holding on to Weaver's forearms, Parker managed to get him out of the window, his feet dangling about 20 feet above the yard.
"I'm letting go," said Parker. "Try to keep your legs bent."
But Weaver was already dead weight, his eyes closed and his chin at his chest. Parker dropped him. Weaver landed awkwardly, but by some miracle he came down on his right side, largely sparing his left foot further injury. Seconds later, Parker followed him down. This time, he heard the sirens for real.
Chapter 117. Daniel left Holly sleeping in their shared room. The tender house was quiet as he walked down the stairs. He didn't know where he was going or what he was looking for. He just knew he needed to be alone for a little while. He was trying to process what he had been told, even though some small part of him had always suspected it, had felt it as a dislocation, and glimpsed it in the way his mom looked at him sometimes when she thought he would not notice. She was his mother, yet there was also another. She had lied to him, she and Grandpa Owen both. But Daniel was not angry. Confused, yes, and sad, but not angry. He could not have said why, but it was so. He found the toy room and sat down amid dolls and board games and jigsaw puzzles. Before him was a large painting of mountains against a blue sky, the landscape rendered in big bright colors, the kind that existed only in cartoons. Cartoons, not fairy tales. Daniel heard a noise from one of the toy boxes. It was almost as though he had been hoping for it, and his hope had made it happen. It was the sound of a toy phone ringing. He rummaged among wood and plastic until he found the source, a plastic phone on wheels, not entirely dissimilar to the one he had owned, the one on which Karis would call him. But she was no longer just Karis. She was something more. Daniel put the phone on his lap, lifted the plastic receiver, and held it to his ear.
"Mommy?"
Jennifer watched the gray form kneeling amid the trees, speaking in a voice that sounded like the rustling of dead leaves. Jennifer had been mistaken. She believed it would be for her father to name the dead woman, and thus bring her peace. But she was wrong. In these final moments, she was no longer a vestige of Karis Lamb. Karis Lamb was before. But with the crying of a child, she had been transformed. What came after was another. What came after was Mommy. As she listened to the voice of her child acknowledge her at last, the gray being began to slip away, disintegrating into splinters, dirt, and dust, carried off into the darkness until all that was left was the memory of her, held in the heart of a boy. Daniel hung up the phone. He was tired. He wanted to sleep now. Candy stood at the door. Daniel did not know how long she had been there.
"Come,"
said Candy.
"I'll bring you back to your mother."
And after only the slightest of hesitations, Daniel took her hand.
Chapter 118. Owen Weaver survived. His lungs were damaged, and he would always walk with a limp, but he would live. Louis survived. He was concerned that his principal sexual organ might never be the same, but the doctors assured him it would continue to function as well as before, just not for a little while. Parker, nursing a busted ankle, advised Louis to think clean thoughts. Louis told Parker to go fuck himself. And Angel survived, although he was quieter now, and sometimes he found himself numbering his days. In the matter of Daniel Weaver,
there would be pain and recriminations, court cases and custody hearings. Moxie Caston would do what he could for all involved. And because Moxie was a most accomplished attorney, nobody would serve jail time, and Daniel Weaver would call Holly Weaver and no other his mother. The tale of the woman in the woods would enter the lore of the state, and like all good stories, much of the truth of it was destined to remain hidden. The man named Quayle vanished, and the woman called Moores vanished with him, although she left a trail of blood in her wake, both figuratively and literally. Louis was right. He had hit her. For the time being, Parker chose to store in a safe deposit box the single vellum page he had kept from Quayle, while Bob Johnston worked on establishing its provenance. And eventually, Parker sat down with S.A.C. Edgar Ross of the FBI and shared with him most of what he knew about Quayle and the vellum leaves. Parker did so with some reluctance. Ross had once sent a private detective to spy on Sam, Parker's daughter. Why, Parker did not know. Although Parker had decided to keep his knowledge of the surveillance to himself for now. So he did not entirely trust Ross. But then, Parker had never entirely trusted Ross. Chapter 119. The principal backer sat in the library of the Colonial Club, sipping a scotch. Thinking. Worrying. Quayle and Moores were gone. They had not availed themselves of the backer's assistance in returning to England, choosing instead a route home via Mexico, which suggested a certain lack of trust. And although reports indicated Moores had been injured in the confrontation with Parker, it was also clear that Quayle was in possession of the pieces of his precious fucking atlas when he left. The principal backer had expended a great deal of time and energy in hampering the search for the buried god. He had done so with the active collusion of a number of his fellow backers, each of whom was as anxious as he to ensure the continuance of the status quo. They had wealth, power, and influence, all of which they would someday bequeath to the next generation, old blood in new bottles. But if Quayle was not deranged, and the Atlas could do as he claimed, then the world was already being reordered, its boundaries redrawn in preparation for the coming of the not-gods, and the war on the old. The backers would not be spared. No one would. Not unless Quayle was stopped. Chapter 120. The funeral of Billy Stonehurst took place on a clear spring morning amid blossoms, birdsong, and rebirth, when no young man should be laid to rest. A choir sang, and handshakes and sympathy were offered to the grieving parents. Afterward, drinks and a buffet were served at a hall in South Portland, not far from the cemetery. During the reception, Bobby Ocean's wife slapped her husband repeatedly on the face. She subsequently departed and did not return. 2 weeks later, Bobby Ocean commenced his retirement from business and initiated the sale of his companies. 2 weeks after that, he and his wife announced their separation. By then, Bobby Ocean was already in the process of establishing, in memory of his son, the William Stonehurst Foundation for American Ideas, which would quickly ally itself with the American Freedom Party, American Renaissance, the Council of Conservative Citizens, and the National Policy Institute, among other white power organizations. Bobby Ocean had become pure hatred. Parker ran into Gordon Walsh after a movie at the Nickelodeon. Walsh was with a woman Parker didn't recognize, and he was no longer wearing a wedding ring. Walsh introduced the woman as Jessica, but offered no further details. He and Parker stood outside the theater while Jessica went to the bathroom. It was the first time the two men had spoken properly since Parker's brief confinement in Augusta.
"I wanted to apologize for calling you a son of a bitch," said Walsh. "I mean, you are a son of a bitch occasionally, but I wouldn't like to think it defined you."
You should market that as a greeting card. I have others. I'll just add it to the pile.
You see that thing about Bobby Ocean? Said Parker.
That far-right business? Yeah, no surprise, but still.
Not good.
No, said Walsh.
He sniffed at the night air.
You smell that?
Jessica appeared beside Walsh.
Smell what? Said Parker.
Walsh laid his left hand on Parker's shoulder and used his right to point in the direction of Commercial and the waterfront and a parking lot, still slightly blackened by fire.
A hint of smoke, said Walsh. You shouldn't have let Louie burn that truck.
It took Parker a few moments to respond.
You're right, he said. Yeah?
I shouldn't have left it to a black man to call out a racist. I should have done it myself.
Chapter 121. The crossword setters for the Times of London took great pride in their work and rarely invited or tolerated outside interference in their puzzles. It took a great deal of convincing, the intervention of an agent of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the promise of some small favors to the newspaper's parent company, and indeed to the setters themselves, before the insertion of a very particular set of clues into the cryptic crossword of March 30th was permitted. Even then, rumblings of immense discontent accompanied the inclusion of one clue, because its appearance would require an apology to be made to Times Cruciverbalist the following day, with all blame for the error being ascribed to a mysterious and forever unnamed assistant. London's Jamaica Wine House, a wood-paneled Victorian pub, lies in St. Michael's Alley, a pedestrian laneway between Cornhill and Lombard Street, not far from the Thames. On March 30th, shortly after midday, a figure dressed in velvet and tweed sat at a quiet table to the rear, drinking coffee and studying, as was his wont, the Times crossword. The Jamaica was one of his regular haunts, although he had not been seen in its environs for some time, and he appeared more troubled than usual, and was short with the staff. He was musing on 10 down, which read, "To pursue, fearful or not, the bird thus flown." A poor but obvious clue, he thought, and well below the usual standards of the setter. It seemed to him that hunting quail must be the answer, but the final letter had to be E to allow for locomotive, the reason perhaps for a murder on the Orient Express, while the second last must surely be bombshell, alarming blast of beauty. But how could the compiler misspell quail as Q-U-A-Y-L-E? There would be complaints about it. The lawyer Quayle paused. He looked at 9 across, another odd clue that had bothered him with the awkwardness of its construction. Jazzes up, but only once the vehicle is secure. That had to be Charlie Parker. He placed circles around the solutions to the 2 clues in question, isolating 4 words. Charlie Parker, hunting quail. Quail looked around him. He was alone and unwatched. The trouble was, he no longer felt alone or unwatched. He folded the newspaper and left the Jamaica to lose himself in crowds.
The Woman in the Woods, a thriller, was written by John Connolly and read by Jeff Harding. The music mix was by Terry Hogan. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Woman in the Woods, a thriller, is available in print from Emily Bestler Books, an imprint of Atria Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.